Moving on into the message today, for those of you who have been in the church for some time, if I were to give descriptions of various biblical figures, I'd say most would be able to identify them because we've heard the descriptions so often. For instance, man after God's own heart, David, all right? Father of the faithful, Abraham, right? Apostle of love, John. Some may have somewhat of a concern with this one or a problem with this one. Impetuous. I like to use that term for him. Impetuous. If you don't know what the term is, you won't even know who he is. But that would be Peter. Self-righteous. Self-righteous. You've been around for a while. There's only one person, for the most part, that has been described as self-righteous in the Bible, Job. Job. That hyphenated word, self-righteous, does not appear in the Bible. Self does, righteousness does, but the hyphenated word self-righteous or self-righteousness does not appear in Scripture. The New World Dictionary of the American language defines the adjective self-righteousness or self-righteous as this: filled with or showing one's own conviction of being morally superior or more righteous than others. That this adjective primarily means being more righteous than others or morally superior to others. The question I ask through this message, is this Job's problem? Is this Job's problem? Religious works point to the Pharisees in general, and the example over here in Luke chapter 18, we'll go there before we get back to the book of Job. You can, hopefully you've got the spot in Job marked. We're going to go right there after Luke chapter 18. This is a specific example of self-righteousness of one of the Pharisees. Luke chapter 18, verses 9 to 12. It says, also he spoke this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee, the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, God, I thank you that I am not like other men. I am not an extortioner. I am not unjust. I am not an adulterer, or even like this tax collector over there. See the superiority in the thinking. Verse 12, I fast twice in the week. I give tithes of all that I possess. Looking at this description, is this Job's problem? Before going forward with Job's comments, let's review what we covered last week in Job chapter 1 and 2. Let's go back to Job chapter 1. Job chapter 1, we find his blessings are enumerated at the beginning of the book. We come to verse 5 of Job chapter 1. As it says, so it was when the days of feasting had run their course that Job would send and sanctify them, these are his children, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus Job did regularly. Now, if his children committed sin, or even if it was a fleeting thought, this is of his children, Job dealt with it. How much more about himself, that he dealt with problems even in his own life? The angels appeared before God, and we find Satan coming as well, verse 8 of chapter 1. Then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? That there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, and one who fears God and shuns evil. Now, God said that the man was righteous. Satan couldn't find a flaw. He can find them in us. That's not a problem for him. He could not find a flaw in Job. He could not point Job to Job and says, yes, that man is full of himself. He's self-righteous, and self-righteousness is a sin. So God is not saying that is his problem. God says the man was blameless. He's upright. And Satan couldn't find a problem with him. Verse 9. So Satan answered the Lord and said, does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, around all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands and his possessions and have increased in the land. But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. Now Satan is accusing us before God day and night, according to Revelation chapter 12. He could not accuse Job of sin. So he goes to ulterior motives. And he attributes that not just only to Job, but to all of us. That we serve God for what we can get from God. Satan made this proclamation before the entire universe. Human beings would not serve God if somehow blessings are taken away from them. Somehow they're experiencing problems. And they continue on and on and on. God gave Satan permission to do this to Job. This is why the man suffered. The blessings were allowed to be removed from him. But we find an attitude of Job emerging even as all that he had was taken away. His children were killed. Verse 20. Then Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, and he fell to the ground and worshiped. He falls down in worship. Most of us would start asking the question, why is this happening to me? Why am I going through all of this? This is not right. It is not fair. Verse 21, and he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. Job did not sin. God knew something about that man at this point in time in his life. He knew this man would not curse God as Satan had proposed. So God allowed Satan and his henchmen to appear before him again in chapter 2, and we come to verse 3. It says, chapter 2, verse 3, then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? There is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil. And still he holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause. Again, God says he is righteous. Satan could not find a problem with the man. So now he gains permission to afflict him bodily with painful sores. They were very, very difficult to deal with. But as it says at the end of verse 10 of chapter 2, in all this, Job did not sin with his lips. That is a different point from chapter 1, verse 5. Chapter 1, verse 5, he was concerned about the heart of his children. And I'm sure that was the concern he had even for himself. Here we come to the point where he does not curse God or sin with his lips. What is going on in his heart? What is happening there? It doesn't reveal much, But as we see this unfold, we can see a problem of Job emerging. And the question is it self-righteousness? Chapter 3. There is a definite attitude change of Job from chapter 1, verse 20, to the end, where it says, "Naked I came into this world, and naked I will return. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And chapter 3. Chapter 3 can be divided into three parts. Three parts. Verses 1 to 10. Job wants a curse placed on the day of his birth. He wants a curse on his birthday. I'm going back to the New Living Translation. I've referenced the point before. When going through the writings of the Old Testament, it's good to use a modern translation in the writings. So I'm going to be using the New Living Translation again. We'll only look at verse 1 of chapter 3 in this first section. Chapter 3, verse 1, it says, "At last Job spoke, and he cursed the day of his birth." He describes it as a day of darkness, day of clouds, blackness. Don't let anyone rejoice on that day. It's a day of cursing. So he cries out, "Why was I ever born?" That's his first question in this chapter. Why was I ever born? The second section, verses 11 to 19. Verses 11 and 19. Here he desires death. He desires to die. Verse 11. "Why didn't I die at birth as I came from the womb?" First question, why was I ever born? Now we come to the second question, why didn't I die when I came out of the womb? You can see there's a change in this man. The third section of chapter 3, verses 20 to 26. Verses 20 to 26. He questions God's purpose in this sore trial he is experiencing. Verse 23. It says, "Why is life given to those with no future, those destined by God to live in distress? What I always feared has happened to me," verse 25. "What I dreaded has come to me, to be." Verse 26, "I have no peace, no quietness. I have no rest. Instead, only trouble comes." And I might just add, and keeps coming and coming and coming. And so we look at this chapter. His first question, why was I born? The second, but having been born, why didn't I die when I came out of the womb? And we come to the third question, and since that didn't happen, why can't I die now? He's obsessed with it in this chapter. Now, I don't think that Job was thinking of committing suicide. I believe what he wants is God to end his suffering, or God to take his life. Or God to take his life. At this point, the whole book shifts its focus. We come to the heart of the book, the dialogue or the debate between Job and his three friends. They came to mourn him. They came to comfort him in chapter 2, but they accused him of committing some great sin. "You've committed some heinous sin," and that was our focus last time in the Bible study. They each take three rounds with Job. The first round, they state their theological view. The second round, they try sarcasm and irony. And finally, they just go out for a frontal attack. They just go out for an attack on Job. Job's reaction. At first, he's irritated with his friends, but then he becomes angry, and then finally, he's sarcastic. But I want to look at his responses to his friends. As we look at his responses, we begin to see emerging Job's problem. And the question, is it self-righteousness? After Eliphaz, the Temanite, speaks, chapter 6, verse 24. Chapter 6, verse 24. It says, "All I want is a reasonable answer. Then I will keep quiet. Tell me, what have I done wrong?" He's simply saying, if there's something wrong, then tell me. You're accusing me of committing some great sin. What was it? What is it? I don't know what it is. His dilemma is that he knows God is doing this to him, but he can't find the reason why. He knows there is nothing in his life that he has not already confessed, that he has not already dealt with. I can just imagine going through his mind over and over again. He can go through the alphabet from A to Z. He is enumerating sin after sin, even if he did not even think he committed it. He apologized to God for it. He went through this over and over and over again, but the problem kept going on and on. I don't say he is claiming, hey, I'm just this sinless being here, but if there is a sin that he is knowledgeable of, he confronted it, he dealt with it. So why is it going on? Over in chapter 7, the first five verses, it says, is this not the struggle of all humanity? A person's life is long and hard, like that of a hired hand, like a worker who longs for the day to end. Some can go back many, many years ago when you had those who worked out in the fields cutting sugarcane or whatever it may be, and they just get out there in the field before sun up. They are there until sundown. They have a little break in between, and they're just going constantly. It is a long, wearisome work. He says, this is what I feel like. What they have gone through, verse 3 of chapter 7, I too have been assigned months of futility, long and weary nights of misery. When I go to bed, I think, when will it be morning? But the night drags on, and I toss till dawn. My skin is filled with worms and scabs. My flesh breaks open full of pus. The indication here is that this trial has been going on at least for months. There was a point in time in the past when we believed that it had gone on for 7 years. It could have very well have gone on 4 years. This is an extended trial Job is going through. Dropping down then, verse 7 of chapter 7. O God, remember that my life is but a breath, and I will never again experience pleasure. You see me now, but not for long. Your eyes will be on me, but I will be dead. Just as a cloud dissipates and vanishes, those who die will not come back. They are gone forever from their home, never to be seen again. In a sense, he's given up. He thinks he will never see any relief. This thing has been going on and on and on, and he believes he's going to die without finding out an answer. And out of this meaningless suffering, he cries out, verse 11, I cannot keep from speaking. I must express my anguish. I must complain in my bitterness. Am I a sea monster that you place a guard on me? Am I Jaws? Am I Shamu? Am I Moby Dick? And you, Captain Ahab? Verse 13, if I think, my bed will comfort me. And I will try to forget my misery with sleep. You shatter me with dreams. You terrify me with visions. I would rather die of strangulation than go on and on like this. I hate my life. I do not want to go on living. Oh, leave me alone for these few remaining days. What are mere mortals that you should make so much of us? For you examine us every morning and test us every moment. Why won't you leave me alone even for a moment? Have I sinned? What have I done to you, O watcher of all humanity? Why have you made me your target? Am I a burden to you? Why not just pardon my sin and take away my guilt? For soon I will lie down in the dust and die. When you look for me, guess what, God? I'm going to be gone. He's expressing his frustration at this trial. And he's expressing his frustration at God.
at God. You see this hopelessness, this futility that's emerging from the man. God, leave me alone. I've had enough. If you're not going to stop this trial, then put me to death. Is that self-righteousness? Or what? Or what? We can see the overall picture. Job doesn't. And his problem is unfolding. Over to chapter 9, in verse 3. It says, if someone wanted to take God to court, would it be possible to answer him even once in 1,000 times? Now Job is getting bolder. He wants to go to court with God. And he wants to prove his innocence. And if he is innocent, who's guilty? Who's guilty? Drop down in the chapter to verse 21, in which he says, again, this is New Living Translation, I am innocent. If I am, that means God's guilty, right? I am innocent, but it makes no difference to me. I despise my life. Chapter 9, 22, innocent or wicked, it is all the same to him. That is why I say he destroys both the blameless and the wicked. He laughs when a plague suddenly kills the innocent. He's really getting kind of bold here, right? It's like God was laughing when typhoon hit the Philippines. God was laughing with the earthquakes occurred down in Chile or in Central America, or Haiti experiences its problems. He is laughing. There is this new craze among crazy teenagers called the knockout game, in which they go down the street and pick out a person at random and see if they can hit that person who is not even knowing that it is coming, knock them out with one blow. And several have died from this as these kids walk away, you know, laughing, chuckling at what they've just done. Is God laughing at such an event? That's insane. But something is happening to this man. Verse 24 of chapter 9. The whole earth is in the hands of the wicked, and God blinds the eyes of the judges and let them be unfair. If not he, then who? Verse 32 of chapter 9. God is not a mortal like man, like me, so I cannot argue with him or take him to trial. If only there were a mediator who could bring us together, but there is none. The mediator could make God stop beating me, and I would no longer live in terror of his punishment. Then I could speak to him without fear, but I cannot do that in my own strength. Job is calling for a mediator between himself and God. Do you see what is emerging here? Is Job comparing himself in a superior manner to other human beings? Where is his comparison? He wants now to bring God into court and somebody above God and himself mediate. Is this self-righteousness? Or what? Do you see what's going on? Job does sin. He repents in chapter 42. But of what? Self-righteousness? Go to chapter 10. Beginning with verse 1, verses 1 to 3. He says, I am disgusted with my life. Let me complain freely. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. I will say to God, don't simply condemn me. Tell me the charge you are bringing against me. What do you gain by oppressing me? Why do you reject me, the work of your hands, while sending joy and prosperity to the wicked? You're rewarding the wicked and punishing the innocent. Is that right, God? Is it self-righteousness? Are you seeing what is unfolding here in terms of his problem? Dropping down, verse 20 of chapter 10. He says, I only have a little time left, so leave me alone, that I may have a little moment of comfort. In other words, he says, let me know or let me go. One or the other. Sure, when you've gone through a continuing trial, suffering, pain, sickness, and it just seems to go on, and you pray and you pray, and we have talked about many years in the past, unanswered prayer. You pray and you pray and you're looking for an answer and nothing seems to come. What's going on here, God? You search the inventory of your own life spiritually. You take a self-assessment. What have I done? Why is this going on? And answer me, God. And it seems as if nothing is happening. Chapter 13 describes how, through the long hours of anguish, he is planning what he would say if God ever gave him a chance. He first pleads for certain conditions he feels are necessary before he is able to stand and talk to God. Verse 18 of chapter 13. I have prepared my case. Done his homework. He's gone to the law library of the ash heap. I will be proved innocent. Who can argue with me over this? If you could prove me wrong, I would remain silent until I die. Oh God, there are two things I beg you. I will be able to face you if you will grant those to me. 21, remove your hand from me, 1. And 2, don't terrify me with your awesome presence. In other words, lift the pain. I know it's coming from you. Lift the pain, lift this anguish, because I don't want to be talking to you through the pain, and then kind of veil your presence because I know how awesome you are indeed. But what is he doing? Luke chapter 18 with the Pharisee, I'm not an extortioner. I fast twice in the week. The Pharisee is comparing himself to other human beings. He's morally superior. Job is comparing himself to whom? And in his own mind, what is unfolding here? To whom is he superior? See this problem unfolding. Next is his appeal for knowledge. Verse 22 of chapter 13. Now summon me, and I will answer. Or let me speak to you, and you reply. Tell me, what have I done wrong? Show me my rebellion and my sin. Why do you turn away from me? Why do you consider me your enemy? Is this self-righteousness? Or what? Frustration? Yes. Discouragement? Yes. Bitterness of spirit? Yes. And something else. Something else is emerging here. Then in chapter 14, Job brings out the helplessness, hopelessness of man before God. And he looks at God like a big bully. First, he is helpless to control his own affairs. Chapter 14, verse 1. How frail is humanity? How short is life? How full of trouble? Like a flower, we blossom for a moment and then wither. Like the shadow of a passing cloud, we quickly disappear. Verse 5. You have decided the length of our lives. You know how many months we will live. And we are not given a minute longer. So give us a little rest, won't you? Turn away your angry stare. We are like hired hands. So let us finish the task you've given us. That man is helpless before God. God, as he's already brought out, you're treating me like I'm target practice. Right? Whether it is that you've got the gun and you're using me now as target practice, or you've got the darts and you're throwing them at me. Self-righteous? Verses 7 to 12, he continues this sense of hopelessness and futility of chapter 14. If a tree is cut down, there is hope that it will sprout again and grow new branches. Though its roots have grown old in the earth and its stump decays, at the scent of water, it may bud and sprout again like a new seedling. But when people die, they lose all strength. They breathe their last. And then, where are they? As water evaporates from a lake, and as a river disappears in the drought, people lie down and do not rise again. Until the heavens are no more, they will not wake up nor be roused from their sleep. Yet he seems to contradict what he's saying right here in verse 13 to 14 and on. He says, I wish you would hide me with the dead and forget me there until your anger has passed. But mark your calendar to think of me again. In the verse 14, if mortals die, can they live again? This thought would give me hope, and through my struggle, I would eagerly wait for release. You would call and I would answer. You would yearn for me, your handiwork. For then you would count my steps instead of watching me for my sins. My sins would be sealed in a pouch and you would cover over my iniquity. It is somewhat of a veil reference to a resurrection. There is a clearer reference coming up shortly. We have used this quite a bit in funeral sermons. If a man dies, will he live again? All the days of my appointed time, will I wait till my change comes? Is how we read this in the King James. But you look at it in the context, you just wonder, what is it that he's actually saying? Am I? Then he goes on to state the facts as he understands them in chapter 16. Chapter 16, starting in verse 7. Chapter 16, verse 7, he says, O God, you have ground me down and devastated my family. You have reduced me to skin and bones as proof, they say, of my sins. God hates me and tears angrily at my flesh. He gnashes his teeth at me and pierces me with his eyes. He likens God to a wild animal, and he's a helpless victim. God is like this growling bear or lion that now has him in his sight and now is coming at him, tearing him apart. Verse 10 of chapter 16, people jeer and laugh at me. They slap my cheek in contempt. A mob gathers against me. I mean, this is going on in his life. He's already going through this. He doesn't know why he's experiencing it. And now people are coming around as he is on the ash heap. They are now abusing him physically. They are hurling sarcastic remarks at him. Verse 11, God has handed me over to sinners. He has tossed me into the hands of the wicked. I was living quietly until he broke me apart. He took me by the neck and dashed me to pieces. Then he set me up as his target. His archers surrounded me, and his arrows pierced me without mercy. The ground is wet with my blood. God, you're nothing but a bug. You know, you've been around for a while. If your child came ever close to what Job is saying to God, his mouth would not be washed out with Lysol. His mouth would be slapped off of his face. Yet God is so patient. Lets him just go on off and spout and spout and spout. But who is he comparing himself to? Other human beings. Chapter 19, verses 23 to 27. It says, "Oh, that my words could be written. Oh, that they could be inscribed on a monument, carved with an iron chisel, and filled with lead, engraved forever in the rock. But as for me, I know that my Redeemer lives, and that he will stand upon the earth at last." Words immortalized by George Friedrich Handel. But three times he refers to this intercessor, this individual. He refers to him as a mediator in chapter 9. Chapter 16, verse 19, he calls him a redeemer or witness. And here he calls him a redeemer in chapter 19. Verse 26, "After my body has decayed, yet in my body," or as we understand that from the Hebrew, "out of my body I will see God. I will see him for myself. Yes, I will see him with my own eyes. I am overwhelmed at the thought." Seems to be somewhat of a contradiction to chapter 16, and you can find contradictions in this book, but this would no doubt be one of the earliest references to the resurrection in the Bible. The one we have in chapter 14 is somewhat veiled, but this one is a clear reference to the resurrection in the Old Testament, one of the first ones historically in the Bible. We go over to chapter 21, verse 4. Chapter 21, verse 4, "My complaint is with God, not with people. No wonder I'm so impatient." Amazing. Now, I know I am impatient, but I'm impatient with people. Job is saying, I'm impatient with God. You see this problem unfolding? Drop down in this chapter, verse 22. "But who can teach a lesson to God, the supreme judge? One person dies in prosperity and security, the very picture of good health. Another person dies in bitter poverty, never having tasted the good life. Both alike are buried in the same dust, both eaten by the same worms. Life just seems to be so unfair." And this is what causes many people to question Christianity. I don't know why it is when problems occur in life, that's the only time they want to drag God into the discussion. Where is God? Why did you allow this to happen? Why did you let little Tommy die? Where's God? If there is a good God, why does he allow this kind of thing to happen? Job is raising the same question 4,000 years ago. That brings us to chapters 23 and 24 as he asks two questions, one in chapter 23, one in chapter 24. The great unanswered questions that still plague man today. In chapter 23 is asking, why is God so seemingly absent from human affairs? Where's God? Chapter 23, verses 3 to 5 only. Chapter 23, 3 to 5. "If only I knew where to find God, I would go to his throne and talk with him there. I would lay out my case and present my arguments. Then I would listen to his reply and understand what he says to me." Then we move into chapter 24, the second question. Why is God silent?
Why doesn't he judge evil? Why does he stay silent for so long? Chapter 24, verse 1 only. It says, why doesn't the Almighty open the court and bring judgment? Why must the godly wait for him in vain? Bold. Very bold. In chapter 27, Job begins his final speech after responding to Bildad in chapter 26. But he starts in chapter 27, verse 1. Job continued speaking. I make this vow by the living God, who has taken away my rights, by the Almighty, who has embittered my soul. As long as I live, while I have breath from God, my lips will speak no evil, my tongue will speak no lies. I will never concede that you are right until I die. I will defend my innocence. I will maintain my innocence without wavering. My conscience is clear for as long as I live. Where's the comparison? It's almost like if the roles were reversed. God, if you were in my place, I would not treat you like this. So why are you bullying me like you are? Where's the comparison? As what we find in this man, he knows how awesome God is. He knows humans are nothing but dust. But what is he doing? Looking at other dust? He's looking at God. And what is happening? He's bringing God down as he rises. Amazing. Chapter 28 gives the analogy of searching for gold to searching for wisdom, especially in sore trials, something that James brings out in James chapter 1. Count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing the testing of your faith works patience. Let patience have its perfect work. You may be perfect. If you lack wisdom, ask and he'll give it to you. Then in the next three chapters, we come to the concluding comments of Job, chapters 21, 29, 30, and 31. He reviews for us all that has happened. Chapter 29, he is looking back on the good old days. He mentions the blessings he experienced. Chapter 29, verse 1. Job continued speaking. I long for the years gone by when God took care of me, when he lighted the way before me, and I walked safely through the darkness. In my early years, the friendship of God was felt in my home. The Almighty was still with me, and my children were around me. In those days, my cows produced milk in abundance, and my olive groves poured out streams of olive oil. Ah, the good old days. Then he describes the honor he experienced during that time. Verse 9, it says, those were the days when I went to the city gate, took my place among the honored leaders. The young stepped aside when they saw me, and even the aged rose in respect of my coming. The princes stood in silence and put their hands over their mouths. The highest officials of the city stood quietly, holding their tongue in respect. All who heard of me praised me. All who saw me spoke well of me. He's just talking about what happened back at this time. The good old days. They were great. I walked down the street and people just rose up in respect. I'm at the city gate and they appreciated the wisdom that I imparted. They sought me during the good old days. And he speaks of the deeds that he did. Verse 12 of chapter 29. For I helped the poor in their need and the orphans who had no one to help them.
I helped those who had lost hope, and they blessed me. And I caused the widow's hearts to sing for joy. All I did was just and honest. Righteousness covered me like a robe, and I wore justice like a turban. I served as eyes for the blind and feet for the lame. I was a father to the poor and made sure that even strangers received a fair trial. I broke the jaws of godless oppressors and made them release their victims. Compare this to the Pharisee. Is this self-righteousness? Verses 18 to 20, he tells us what his hopes were. I thought, surely I will die surrounded by my family after a long, good life. Who wouldn't want that? Verse 19, for I am like a tree whose roots reach the water, whose branches are refreshed with the dew. New honors are constantly bestowed on me, and my strength is constantly renewed. Yes, as we are growing through this life, and we serve God, and we encounter difficulties, at times it can be very difficult. It can be hard. We can fast and fast and fast, and where are you, God? I need help. This is going on and on and on. I need help. I'm struggling here, God. You see that? When will you intervene in this situation? I've obeyed you. If I've disobeyed you, show me. I will repent. Job had that attitude and just kind of blew up in his face. Blew up in his face. As I mentioned before, we've got two stages here. There's this upper stage and this lower stage. Job doesn't know what's going on, where Satan now is challenging God about how people serve you. They serve you because you bless them. You take it away. You afflict them, and they will stop serving you. And as I look at this trial he experiences and he goes through, thank God he hasn't put something like that on me. What I've often gone through and I look at, I say, hey, this is too much. Read Job. The experiences I go through, look, Job, quintessential example of suffering without an explanation. Then as it goes on, he concludes this section describing his influence. Verse 21. Everyone listened to me and valued my advice. They were silent as they waited for me to speak. And after I spoke, they had nothing to add, for my counsel satisfied them. They longed for me to speak as they longed for rain. They waited eagerly, for my words were as refreshing as the spring rain. When they were discouraged, I smiled at them. My look of approval was precious to them. How would all of us like to be in such a position? Somebody is going through a discouraging time, and you just look at them, and that just encourages them. I told them what they should do and presided over them as their chief. I lived as a king among his troops and as one who comforts those who mourn. How I yearned for the good old days. Now chapter 30. We get to the other side. The dark side. The present affliction and pain. He begins in the first 15 verses describing how men mock him. We'll read several of the verses. Verse 1 of chapter 30. But now I am mocked by those who are younger than I. By young men whose fathers are not worthy to run with my sheepdogs. It goes on to describe their character, how they are evil, unpleasant people.
And yet, verse 9 of chapter 30, now their sons mock me with their vulgar song. They taunt me. They despise me and won't come near me except to spit in my face. You're already down. You're suffering. You're in great pain. How difficult it is to deal with mocking. You already have your three friends who are not helping, accusing you of committing some great sin, and you know you haven't. And now there have been songs composed. You were up here. You were elevated. You were somebody in Ur of the Chaldees, or wherever you were. You were somebody in Uz back then at that time. Now they've composed songs of derision about you. And they sing them and they laugh in your face. How difficult. How difficult. Verses 11 to 15, he describes the insults and attacks. And then the anguish of this physical pain. Verse 16 of chapter 30. Chapter 30, verse 16. And now my heart is broken. Depression haunts my days. My weary nights are filled with pain, as though something were relentlessly gnawing at my bones. With a strong hand, God grabs my garment. He grips me by the collar of my tunic. He has thrown me into the mud. I have become as dust and ashes. God has bullied me, and he hasn't told me why. Verse 20. I cry to you, O God, but you don't answer me. I stand before you and you don't bother to look. You have become cruel toward me. You persecute me with your great power. You throw me into the whirlwind and destroy me in the storm. And I know that you are sending me to my death, the destination of all who live. Surely no one would turn against the needy when they cry for help. Did I not weep for those in trouble? Was I not deeply grieved for the needy? So I looked for good, but evil came instead. I waited for the light, but darkness fell. I am in need. I've helped those who are needy. I've reached out. I fulfilled their need. Now here I am. I'm in need. I'm looking to you, and you are not responding. If conditions were reversed, I would not do this as you're doing it to me. We would not say self-righteous. Here's something worse. He's not comparing himself to human beings. He's raising himself up to the level of God. That's why God comes down so strong on this man, as he does. Describes how he feels persecuted by God, cries out. God doesn't seem to listen to him. And this is, as we have talked, mentioned before, about, as he mentioned about unanswered prayer. Verse 27, he describes now the conclusion of this misery. My heart is troubled and restless. Days of affliction have come upon me. I walk in gloom without sunlight. I stand in the public square and cry for help, but instead I am considered a brother to jackals and a companion to ostriches. My skin has turned dark. My bones burn with fever. My harp plays sad music, and my flute accompanies those who weep, as he is singing the blues. And we come to chapter 31. We get Job's last search for some kind of reason in all of this. He's going back now and trying to find some answer. He's still searching for wisdom. First, he says he has not been guilty of sexual misconduct. Chapter 31, verse 1. I made a covenant with my eyes not to look with lust upon a young woman. And so I return to the New King James. And really, as he lists these things, after each one. He is saying, for the most part, I'm innocent. Verse 5, if I have walked with falsehood, or if my foot has hastened to deceit, let me be weighed on honest scales that God may know my integrity. I am not guilty. Verse 7, if my step has turned from the way, or my heart walked after my eyes, or if any spot adheres to my hands, I am not guilty. Verse 9, if my heart has been enticed by a woman, or if I have lurked at my neighbor's door, I am not guilty. Verse 13, if I have despised the cause of my male or female servant when they complained against me, not guilty. Verse 16, if I have kept the poor from their desire or caused the eyes of the widow to fail, not guilty. Verse 19, if I have seen anyone perish for lack of clothing or any poor man without covering, not guilty. Verse 21, if I have raised my hand against the fatherless when I saw I had help in the gate, not guilty. Verse 24, if I have made gold my hope or said to fine gold, you are my confidence, not guilty. Verse 25, if I have rejoiced because my wealth was great and because my hand had gained much wealth, not guilty. 26, if I had observed the sun when it shines or the moon moving in brightness so that my heart has been secretly enticed and my mouth has kissed my hands, not guilty. 29, if I have rejoiced at the destruction of him who hated me or lifted myself up when evil found him, not guilty. 33, if I have covered my transgressions as Adam by hiding my iniquity in my bosom because I feared the great multitude and dreaded the contempt of families so that I kept silence and did not go out of the door, not guilty. 38, if my land cries out and its furrows weep together, if I have eaten its fruit without money or caused its owners to lose their lives, then let thistles grow instead of wheat and weeds instead of barley. The words of Job are ended. And with this, he finishes. Nothing more to say. Baffled, questioning this torment. Throughout these chapters, now he's silent. Three friends have nothing else to say. Is he self-righteous? He's not comparing himself to other people. He's comparing himself to God. In his words, he is trying to bring God down to his level, and he rises up. And as you read the responses, Job rises above God. That's why this is even greater problem than self-righteousness. Remind you of someone? Isaiah chapter 14. Isaiah chapter 14. Verses 12 to 15. Isaiah chapter 14, beginning with verse 12. How you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning. How are you cut down to the ground, you who weakened the nations? For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will also sit on the mount of the congregation of on the farthest sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High, yet you shall be brought down to Sheol, to the lowest depths of the pit. Lucifer was rich in himself. Job is now at that point where he is rich in himself. You don't read anything else about Satan in all of this. Satan has succeeded. He didn't succeed by taking away all of his possessions and his kids. He didn't succeed with the affliction of poor pain. But he has worked on this man's conscience. He has worked on this man's theology so that Job now is rising higher and higher to even be above God. So God has to bring him down. And that's why I say this is one of the quintessential examples of what it is the opposite of poor in spirit. It is fitting that we conclude this part again with what has been brought out before. Isaiah chapter 40, verse 28. Isaiah chapter 40, verse 28. And reading this out of the NIV. Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 28. It says, how his understanding is unsearchable. God's understanding no one can fathom. But Job tries to qualify it. Job tries to box it up. And that is not possible. We have a tendency at times to make comments thinking they may be of some benefit or help. Oh, you're in the hospital. The doctors have kind of given you pretty much last rites, and someone comes in and says, oh, you're going to be better. How do you know? How do you know? We cannot put ourselves in the position of God. All we can do is appeal to him, and hopefully he might be able to impart the wisdom, because he has to invade the box in which we reside. He has to impart to us the wisdom. I don't have the answers. God does. And I have to appeal to him. And as I do that, chapter 55, verses 8 to 9, chapter 55 of Isaiah, verses 8 to 9, my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. When Job comes to understand this, he sees God in a different light, but the important thing in what we're covering here, he sees himself in a different light. And it's like the air goes out of the balloon when he repents in chapter 42. We'll see that when we come to the final message, but next time we will see what the person who possibly is responsible for the book in the first place, Elihu. He makes some very incisive comments that the friends didn't even make. And he is like the introduction to God that will finish the book, as we'll deal with it next month.